Kenya's Biggest Loser, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's on assignment in Kenya. And today we meet the mom who won Kenya's version of the weight loss show, The Biggest Loser.
So I had to take care of myself. I had to lose weight so that I could be able to take care of my children.
More stories about African women owning it coming up. Plus, a Sikh serving in the U.S. Army remembers what it was like after 9/11.
People were really on edge. In fact, when I went to the airport, I was randomly screened 100% of the time.
And the woman who helps school kids learn English here in Boston remembers her mother's experience in 1950s L.A.
You know, just in conversation in Spanish, her and her siblings would get in trouble and they'd get paddled by the principal.
That's all ahead, right here on The World. All this week, Marco's in Kenya, reporting on women there who are in control of their own business. We'll hear those stories later in the show, but first, the two sides of a very painful decision millions of Syrians have had to make: to stay in Syria and risk their lives in a brutal civil war, or go and hope for a better life elsewhere. In a few minutes, we'll hear how one Syrian family is being welcomed in Germany. Right now, though, we head to the Syrian city of Aleppo and the story of one man determined not to leave his life there. This man's also a father who's watched his five sons join the ranks of the anti-government Free Syrian Army. And his story comes to us via an opposition activist and citizen journalist named Rami Jara. He's a Syrian and British national. Jara spoke earlier with producer Joyce Hackle about life in Aleppo.
I'm currently standing in the street of the Aleppo Old City in an area called Maadi, which is very close to the citadel of Aleppo. This area is basically different from some of the modern structures because there aren't much refugees here. Most of the people that live here are actually from the area. There hasn't been much displacement. So you still get a sense of Aleppo, of what Aleppo used to be before the uprising, before the war. And there's some very sort of old stoned paved road, which is very narrow. So cars coming through here, it's very slow because of the fact that most of the people would be walking on in the middle of the road because these are very narrow streets. There are quite a few people out walking around, a few shops that are open. The other day, I met a man who basically has a shop where he has a barbecue. He didn't used to do this before the war. He used to be a businessman. He's been to Europe, he'd been to Asia, and he's very well informed on many places. This man now works on his barbecue all day, talking to the locals here. Five of his sons are in fact fighting in the Free Syrian Army. He's very proud of that. Every time, you know, he's telling me a story, he keeps mentioning stories about his sons. One of his sons died in an attack 3 months ago. When he was telling me about his son, it almost seemed as if it was obligatory of him to be very accepting to the idea that he'd lost his son. When I dug a bit to ask him to talk about his son and, you know, what are the things that he remembers about him, he became very emotional. And this hardened, strong man who's showing everyone that he's very tough suddenly became like a little child. And it's very sort of emotional to see something like that. Especially from a man that what I've seen over the past few days is that he has a large stack of bread that's on his table. And then whenever anyone's going past, he calls them and he knows that this person is very poor and can't afford any food. He's handing out bread for free. I've seen him basically spend the money he makes on basically handing out stuff to people. And something fascinating also that I've seen about this man is, first of all, I want to understand that now the situation that we're seeing in these areas is that people have become very religious, and we're talking about Islam. So drinking is not something that is popular in any way here, and it's somewhat not accepted at all. This man openly says to everyone that I drink, and I don't trust anyone with a beard. This is what he says. And he mocks the religious people around us and says, well, you know what, it's not about how I pray or... I just think he's a fascinating person, and he's given me the chance to understand more about this area because he's very honest and he tells me what's going on in the area. Someone like this man I'm talking about has the ability to leave the country, whereas that's not really a very popular situation amongst other people where it's really poverty doesn't allow that. But this man, what he's doing, he's making some money. I mean, I can see it. And he knows a lot of people. He did an operation for one of his sons who was wounded and actually had a hip replacement, and he was able to pay for that operation and send his son to Turkey. And then his son wanted to stay in Turkey, and he insisted, no, you have to come back. There's a cause. We can't leave our country. If we leave our country, then it's gone. So this man is able to leave, but he insists on staying here. And he feels very proud of the fact that his children, his sons, are part of this resistance of this area that are defending this area.
Opposition activist and citizen journalist Rami Jari in Aleppo today. He told that story to producer Joyce Hackel earlier. Many Syrians who have fled the war are now refugees in Europe. And the European country that's taken in the most refugees by far is Germany. About 1 million have arrived there in the past year, coming from Syria and many other places. And mostly they've been welcomed by Germans with open arms. In fact, there's a name for it in German, Willkommenskultur. The World's Matthew Bell has more from Berlin on what's behind this welcoming spirit.
About once a week, 36-year-old Zafar, a Berlin taxi driver, stops by this sidewalk outside a government building where refugees line up to register. They're here for hours at a time, and volunteers like Zafar show up with hot drinks and food.
What did you bring today?
Today, what is pizza?
Zafar says he comes here because it's personal for him.
We was also refugees, you know, my mother, my our parents, we think of... from another level, you know.
This from where?
From Pakistan.
Zafar's family has been here for a generation. He was born in Germany, and he says he's proud to see so many of his fellow Germans going out of their way to lend a hand.
This is from the heart. It's coming from the German people. I think so.
My name is Mandy Seidler, and I'm working on a project. It's called Welcome Dinner for Berlin, and we are organizing dinners between Berliners who invite refugees who are new in Berlin for dinner at their home.
Seidler got the idea from an organization in Sweden, and it's as simple as it sounds. The goal is to build connections.
It's always difficult to get to know each other when you are in different communities. So when we are living here, you hear so many things about refugees, but you do not talk to them. And when you invite someone to your home, you need to talk.
It's early days, but one of her project's success stories is about two families, one from Aleppo, Syria, and the other from Berlin.
My wife contacted me and she asked me, "Hey, do you think we should make a welcome dinner in our home?" And I said immediately, yes.
Alexander Kluge is a business consultant who lives with his wife, Sabina, and their two kids in an affluent suburb of the capital.
We wanted to show our kids what we can do for the refugees. And, of course, we were very curious to meet some real refugees, because if you just do a donation, you don't get them to know them. And we wanted to talk to you and see how it is and how it feels to be here.
The Klugas met the family from Aleppo a few months ago, and they've been helping the Syrian couple and their three children with things like finding an apartment and good schools, dealing with official paperwork, and starting to think about job hunting. The father doesn't want to give his name because he's got relatives back in Syria he worries about. He says not all Germans have been as welcoming as the Klugas.
I think not all the same. We find many refuse us and many accept us. You can see it on the street. You just look at the faces and you can see the situation.
Occasionally, he says, strangers have said things like, "Go home." But for the most part, he's been overwhelmed by the generous reception his family's been treated to. Like many Germans, Alexander Kluge grew up hearing refugee stories about his own family.
My family originally had to move from Schlesien, from the east, from Poland now, and they come over. They were refugees. They arrived as refugees in Heidelberg, and they were not treated really good as they arrived. So we have a long tradition of refugees.
And this is something I heard from numerous Germans I met, that when they see refugees arriving from the Middle East, they think about their own family history after World War II, and they feel compelled to welcome these new refugees. But the political winds are shifting in Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel has been under pressure to put a limit on the numbers of refugees entering the country, and she just announced that Germany will significantly reduce the flow of new arrivals because, quote, it's in the interest of everyone. For the World, Matthew Bell, Berlin.
Here in Boston, there are so many immigrants in the city that students in the public schools speak more than 80 different languages at home. A third of the students are classified as English language learners. And about half of those aren't getting the services they need, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. They struggle and drop out at much higher rates than their peers. The World's Jeb Sharp tells us about one of the key people charged with turning that situation around in Boston.
Ask Frances Esparza what her task is as new assistant superintendent in the Office of English Language Learners, and she'll give you a careful, bureaucratic, education-speak answer. But ask her why she's so passionate about language, and she'll tell you a very personal story about growing up fifth-generation Mexican in East L.A. Her mother's generation had their Spanish beaten out of them at school, quite literally.
My mother went to school in the 50s. At a time when she couldn't speak Spanish in school. My mother has 10 siblings. She's the eldest. She was the ringleader of them all. And, you know, just in conversation in Spanish, either on the playground or in passing, her and her siblings would get in trouble and they'd get paddled by the principal.
And the paddling escalated.
Once it got really bad, where they broke her skin. And she wasn't able to go to school for a few days. And so my grandparents kept her home. And with that, what she tells me is basically they wanted her and her brothers and sisters to learn English as fast as possible and just stop speaking in Spanish.
And that's basically what happened. By the time Esparza's generation came along, Mexican culture had been wiped away. She was brought up on bologna sandwiches and Campbell's soup. Out of 117 grandkids, she's one of only 5 who can speak Spanish with her 94-year-old grandfather. Ironically, that's partly because by the time she got to the same elementary school her mother had attended, the school had a special program where she was able to study Spanish for 30 minutes a day. She loved it and kept studying it right through college, reclaiming the language and culture most of her family had lost.
So it is very near and dear to my heart for students to be able to keep their language and their culture. And I don't know if you can see, it's a little emotional for me because, like I said, going back to know that my mom was paddled for that, that hurts.
That passion drove Esparza to leave her career in L.A. and come all the way across the country last summer to take on the daunting task of revamping language instruction in the Boston schools. The fact that the Justice Department had cracked down on the district for failing its English language learners was not a deterrent. It made her want to come and be part of the solution.
This is like a dream to come and work with these populations to be able to implement bilingualism and biliteracy here. And still, of course, number one, learning English. That's one of the most important pieces. However, keeping your culture and your primary language is just as important.
For the World, Jeb Sharp, Boston.
Before the break, a quick look ahead. Marco Werman will be joining me from Kenya. He's there hearing from women who are owning it. Women like Olive Wanjiro, who realized she wasn't eating as healthy as she used to.
Now the fast foods and healthy foods are very, very easily available, and you'll get them anywhere. You can even dial, and they'll deliver. Times have really changed.
Find out how Olive took control of her eating habits and how much money she won doing it. Our story from Kenya, coming up right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. The African Union warned today that it will not allow another genocide on the continent. The warning was about Burundi, Rwanda's neighbor to the south. The two countries have a similar ethnic mix of Hutus and Tutsis. And that was a factor during Burundi's long civil war, which only ended in 2005. But the current trouble is more political. It began with protests last April when the country's president announced he would seek a third term in office. Those protests have led to violence, which continues to escalate. My BBC colleague Robert Mizigaro is from Burundi, and he's been reporting on the situation from London. He says he wouldn't use the G word, genocide, to describe what's going on in his country.
Of course, when you know what happened in Rwanda, there's a reason to be afraid and think, look, this kind of similar. But to use the G word, as you said at the moment, I would say it's going a bit too far, because we don't have an ethnic divide in Burundi at the moment where you have the Hutus who are there against the Tutsis, for example. We don't have that yet, because in the government there's both the Tutsis and the Hutus, and you find the same group, ethnic groups, in the opposition. So the question would be, it's a genocide by who against who? You would need to have that clear line to start thinking of a genocide.
The international community seems, you know, very concerned. And there was a big battle that took place last Friday, and that's the deaths and carnage from that are one of the things that has the international community so upset. What happened then?
Basically, a group of armed men attacked three army barracks in Bujumbura. And apparently they were not very well equipped. The army quickly took control of the situation. So the army says they arrested them, and whoever died was during the crossfire. But the opposition says after the attack, the army went on a killing rampage on the civilian population. So you have two different accounts of what happened.
How many people died in this battle?
The official account is around 87, so it's quite a lot of people. I think the way out, definitely, it's to have a dialogue. I think a dialogue would definitely reach to not the best solution, but at least a solution or something that would actually stop the killings.
Now, this isn't just a conflict in a country in Africa that you're reporting on. You are from Burundi. You've got family in Bujumbura, the capital. What have you heard from them over the last week?
First of all, they're fine. They're fine, so which is a good thing. The area where they live is still safe for the moment. And personally, it's quite difficult because I was there during the war 15 years ago or so. And it was very, very difficult. It was horrible because, of course, you could wake up one morning and hear that your friend has been shot dead. But at the moment, things seem to be localized. It's not widespread. It's not like all over the country. So it still is something that can be controlled. But you never know if it carries on. You never know if it's not going to catch up and then become an open civil war.
How is this crisis affecting daily life in Burundi for your own family there?
Not just actually my own family. Of course, it's affecting everybody in Bujumbura because Bujumbura, it's a city on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, and they have a very nice weather. It looks like a tropical place, really. So at weekends, for example, people go out to the beach, you know, have fun, you know, visit friends. Those kind of things are not happening now, so you can understand how frustrated people are. But also the shootings at night, you know, people, they're not really resting enough. They don't know if something could happen tomorrow. This constant fear, this feeling of not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, it's horrible. That's what they're living now. When you wake up in the morning, you grab your phone and then try to find out if they're still okay. That's the first thing I do personally, so to call my mom or send a WhatsApp message to see if she's okay, if she can, you know, go to the market and buy something to eat, if she can still be able to do that. I mean, it's very worrying because you don't really know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow. It's a very uncertain situation.
The BBC's Robert Mizugaro is a Burundian, and he reports for the BBC, and he's been following the situation in his home country from London. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Burundians here in the United States are keeping a close eye on events back home. The current conflict reminds many of when they fled the country. After civil war broke out in the early 1990s, many Burundians ended up in refugee camps. One way they dealt with the hardship was music, and it's happening again in Pittsburgh. Erica Barris has the story.
Over the last decade, thousands of Burundian refugees have been resettled in the U.S., with a community forming in Pittsburgh. And every Sunday, at the Cornerstone Methodist Church here, about 100 Burundians congregate. Near the altar, a few dozen people dance and sing in Swahili and Kirundi. Three musicians back them up. Yukabwayo Chanceline, who's 24, belts out a solo.
My entire life, since I was little in Africa, I used to sing children choir, and when I came here, I have the same opportunity to do this, so I'm still doing the same. I love singing.
Like many of the younger people at the church, Chanceline is Burundian by blood, not by birth.
I was born in Congo because we have to move to look for the peace. So I was born there, and I actually grew up in Tanzania in a refugees camp, and now I'm here.
The choirs were everywhere at the camps, and now the tradition continues here with at least two Burundian church choirs. They sing about accepting fate, letting love in, and building faith. For Chanceline, the choirs were a lifeline at the refugee camps.
The singing was very, it was something that brought us together, you know, going to church every Sunday, Saturday, going to choir. When I'm singing, it's like I don't care what's going on behind me. I just forgot everything. So singing was very important for especially children. It helped. It helped because we didn't have to keep focusing for like, oh, we are refugees or we don't have food today. What are we going to eat? So we go to church. It was fun.
But it's painful now to talk to family back in Burundi. People are leaving the country.
It's bad sometimes when we talk to them. It's too much tears.
So Chanceline and others at the church offer their prayers, they wait for word from their relatives, and they sing. For The World, I'm Erica Barris, Pittsburgh.
News headlines are coming up in a minute. And then later in the show, I speak with Kamal Singh Khalsi. He's a devout Sikh and a major in the U.S. Army. Part of being a Sikh man means never trimming your beard. And I wondered whether that ever created a problem when Khalsi has to wear, say, a gas mask. He told me no. He makes sure his beard doesn't get in the way.
You know, I tie it up at the bottom of my chin and I use a little bit of hair product and it conforms to my face very nicely. It may look like it's trimmed, but it's actually not. And that's part of the reason why I've had no issues in getting my gas mask to seal on my face.
More of my conversation with Army Major Kamal Singh Khalsi, that's coming up in the second half of the show. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Catherine and Jerry grew up in a Kenyan slum, and she always felt guilty about it until she discovered yoga.
I was able to accept that I was from the slums. You know, I was able to accept it was nobody's fault. And that's what yoga taught me.
And now she's teaching others the same thing. Owning it in Kenya. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Marco Werman is on assignment in Kenya all this week with our Across Women's Lives team as they look at how Kenyan women are owning it in business. Many types of business, as we've been hearing this week. Really fascinating stuff. And Marco, I'm sitting in for you here in Boston, but I gather you've been doing some sitting too.
Yeah, sitting, stretching, downward dog, high plank, low plank, mountain pose. We're going to get physical today with a few Kenyan women who are forging a physical path in their lives and changing attitudes about what women do for a living and also how they perceive and how others around them think of body image. I'm actually coming to you right now from a place in Nairobi called the Jaffrey Sports Club. It's a multi-purpose fitness area. It's outdoors. There's a track where Nairobi residents get their exercise in. There's a playground behind me with kids waiting for their parents. And lots of people this afternoon walking. In a few minutes, The World's Andrea Crossan, she's going to be telling us about Kenya's version of the American reality show, The Biggest Loser. Only here it's called Slim Possible. Concept is basically the same, but it is so different in so many ways. You'll definitely want to stick around and hear why. But first, let me wind back to last week when I first arrived in Kenya.
Walk on a downward facing dog, bend one knee at a time.
I hadn't even been in Nairobi for 24 hours when I went to meet Catherine and Jerry to tell her story and why she does what she does for a living. I was a little intimidated because she's a yoga teacher and I agreed to take one of her classes. I do yoga almost every morning, but I tend to take it slowly just to get the kinks out from the night before. And Jerry's practice is power yoga.
And breathe into your hips and breathe out of your hips.
After about 30 minutes, I looked like I had just walked out into a Nairobi downpour, and I still had an hour to go. And Jerry doesn't mess around, but then again, she came to yoga in a no-mess-around kind of way.
So it was a funny story. I think the practice discovered me.
The practice discovered her in the midst of violent political upheaval in Kenya in 2007. That was the year of the disputed presidential election here. In a country where few thought ethnic violence would ever be a problem, suddenly people were killing each other and burning down neighbors' homes. At the time, Njeri was working as an acrobat and began touring the country with a group of other acrobats, going to camps for people displaced by the violence. Also in those camps, yoga teachers providing some sorely needed exercise and distraction. And Jerry noticed that between the acrobatics and the yoga, the ethnic divides started to evaporate.
As we went into the camps, you could see the different groups sitting differently. Like we could tell that's a specific group, this is a specific group. And by when we started performing, people came to watch. And when we were doing yoga, they forgot the differences. And you could see people touching hands on mountain poses. You could see people speaking to each other.
That was the germ of the Africa Yoga Project, along with assistance from well-known yoga instructors Paige Ellison and Baron Baptiste. Catherine and Jerry traded in her life as an acrobat to devote it to yoga.
I was training young kids to be acrobats, but I noticed like yoga, I could teach my mom to do. Like my mom was my first student.
Today, the Africa Yoga Project has grown into a teacher training program for Kenyans. Not just Kenyans, aspiring yogis from a dozen African countries also come to train in Kenya as instructors. And the courses are free, which is pretty remarkable. Like right here, where Catherine grew up, in the Nairobi slum of Kariobangi, where she's motivating young students and maybe some new instructors.
I came back and started teaching in another social hall. It's a community hall, and then Joyce was my student. And when there was a scholarship for someone to become a yoga teacher, she joined. And then I could no longer teach here because then she needed somewhere to teach.
Nice. Yeah. High plank. Low plank.
On this day, Njeri is not earning her usual pay for leading expats in Nairobi through low plank and downward dog. She's observing a new teacher run a free class specifically for young women and new mothers. The studio in Kariobangi is a shoebox-sized church, and it's not like any yoga class I've ever seen. The cement floor was covered in red dust, and the mats hadn't been cleaned in a while. But the students packed the room. A lot of them were first-timers. One girl told me she was there to improve herself, to deal with her tummy, she said. Toddlers crawled across the mats during class. A new mother had to pause several times to nurse her baby. Catherine and Jerry observed while Joyce, the newer instructor, a young woman and Jerry mentored in the practice, patiently taught the newcomers.
I can hear a lot of Americans hearing this and saying, okay, yoga may be good for me, but when we're talking people in a slum, I mean, dire poverty,
yeah,
doesn't that need to be solved first and then they can do yoga?
Mm-hmm.
How has it actually worked out?
You know, first of all, I'll say acceptance of the situation comes first. Like
acceptance of poverty.
Yeah. I was able to accept that I was from the slums. You know, I was able to accept it was nobody's fault. And then that's what yoga taught me. And personally, I think now we have a lot of people doing yoga. It's because they are starting to realize it's nobody's fault that I'm poor. And yeah, the government has to do something. The world has to do something. But I also don't have to sit down. I need to stand up and do something. And Africa Yoga Project is like kind of closing the gap because all people we employ at Africa Yoga Project are youths from the slums. You have to be unemployable to be employed at Africa Yoga Project. And when we come, Africa Yoga Project is trying to reduce the unemployment in Kenya through yoga.
Is it working?
Yeah. We have 100 yoga teachers.
So Catherine came out of poverty with a belief that she could change her life and now kind of believes that she can change the world around her. I think she's got really good reason to believe that. We have another story for you now, also based here in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, about some women changing the world around them. in a very personal way. But from the individual, the changes radiate out to Nairobi at large, especially Nairobi, where you find lots of fast food joints. I just saw the first Domino's franchise in the city, only recently opened. There's also Kentucky Fried Chicken everywhere and lots of other local fried chicken joints. The supermarkets also are filled with all kinds of biscuits and cookies, and people like to carb up here. It's a cheap way to keep you up to speed, you know, with the pace of city life. Now, in the States, we have the reality program The Biggest Loser. There's a similar TV show here that's become pretty popular. It's called Slim Possible. And my colleague, the world's Andrea Crossan, who incidentally has been producing the segments here in Kenya that you've been hearing from us all this week, Andrea went to meet the most recent winner and to find out why Slim Possible is so different from The Biggest Loser.
The winner, ladies and gentlemen, Slim Possible Season 6, Olive Wanjiru.
Last month, Olive Wanjiru picked up 1 million Kenyan shillings, about $10,000. By losing 50 pounds over 15 weeks, Wanjiru became the winning contestant on Slim Possible. On this morning, Wanjiru is more busy young mom of two toddlers than reality TV star. The only indication of her recent good fortune is the giant check from Slim Possible propped on her mantle. But for Wanjiru, her win wasn't about the money, although it didn't hurt. It was about turning around years of poor eating habits. She says she started gaining weight at 14.
After high school, it kept on piling. Then I got married and, of course, babies came. And it even piled more.
Wanjiru says things are so different now than her mother's generation, when everyone tended a home garden or shamba.
They used to eat healthy foods straight from the shamba, very healthy, very organic foods. But now the fast foods and healthy foods are very, very easily available, and you'll get them anywhere. You can even dial and they'll deliver. Times have really changed.
A recent study showed that a shocking 40% of Nairobi women are obese. That's twice the national average. Lena Jirogi is a nutritionist and has worked in a hospital here for many years. Steadily, she saw more people coming in with type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Jirogi is also one of the creators of the show Slim Possible.
When we started the program, we actually could not get people on the show. We actually handpicked, you know, because issues of obesity, people never used to talk about weight. They are very shy. And nobody, moreover, now go on national television and talk about the struggles, and people didn't want to be exposed.
There were also cultural issues. In Kenya, some extra meat on your bones, especially in places that could be called, well, bootylicious, is considered attractive.
Many people actually don't even want to lose weight because they're saying they don't want to lose their hips or they don't want to lose their, you know, their behind. It's not that slim is better, you know.
But the message is getting through. It's important to be healthy, even if waist thin isn't what you're shooting for. At a recent casting call for Slim Possible Season 6, more than 1,000 women showed up. With the American version of the show, The Biggest Loser, contestants live on a ranch with full-time trainers who kick their butts and nutritionists who plan their meals. On Slim Possible, contestants live at home. They make their own meals and schedule exercise around work and family. The contestants come in every week to be weighed. They also get their cholesterol, blood sugar levels checked, and have their body mass index measured. The mission of the show is to promote healthy living, not crash dieting. But a cash prize is a powerful motivator, and some contestants try to take shortcuts.
Some of the participants, you know, in 1 week would come and they've lost like 7 kilos, and I'm like, that's too much in a week, you know? And you're like, fine, we are talking about weight loss, but it's just not about the weighing scale.
Yes, so in my fridge, I don't think there is actually anything. It's almost empty. These are just vegetables. So there's some carrots and cucumbers. Then we have our watermelon. And then we have the frozen cereals.
Slim Possible winner Olive Wanjiru showed me the inside of her fridge. It doesn't contain a single pizza box or frozen dinner, just nutritious food. And it was by eating well that she won, because here's the thing, she didn't lose the most weight. Wanjiru was not the biggest loser. In the end, it was her slow and steady weight loss that earned her the win by the judges. It was not about starving herself or losing her curves. She just became a healthier woman and mother.
When you become a mother, I think you have to take care of yourself first. so that you can be able to take care of someone else. So I had to take care of myself. I had to lose weight so that I could be able to take care of my children. So I know I have a long way to go, but for now, I am just feeling good, and I'm happy. I'm really happy.
So striking a balance between good health and happiness and feeling good about the way you look. That was Slim Possible winner Olive Wanjiro ending that story by the world's Andrea Crossan, who's been producing our segments this week here with Across Women's Lives in Kenya. Owning it, and Olive surely owns it. We'll be here one more day in Kenya, wrapping things up tomorrow with some really fun stories about owning it. We'll be going on a safari with one of the very few women guides in the animal paradise, that is the Maasai Mara. And we'll also have Gina Moore from BuzzFeed back tomorrow to tell us the story of a well-known comedian in this part of Africa who is owning it. Gina, you know, comedy is such a great way of peeling back a culture, getting under the hood of what makes a place tick and talk. Who is this woman, and why is she making people laugh? Why do you like her?
She's called Kensime Ann. She's known as Kensime, and I love this woman. Kenyans love this woman. Ugandans love this woman. She's huge in East Africa because she's so real. The things she makes comedy out of are everyday life scenarios, and I like her because she has a little bit of a feminist edge to what she does. On top of that, I really admire her because she's figured out how to make a very good living in arts and entertainment, which is almost impossible here.
I think the first time I got a check of like 12,000, I will never forget that day.
More from comedian Kensime Ann tomorrow, along with Gina Moore, the international women's rights correspondent for BuzzFeed. They'll both be back with us tomorrow for a few laughs as we end things here in Nairobi. All right, one more thing today on the subject of owning it. You should check out a blog post we've got up right now at PRI.org. The World put out a call to working moms, and we heard from a lot of you. And Valerie Young of Washington, D.C. responded with some very wise words about how she's negotiated the twists and turns of a world where, as she puts it, when you look like you make money, the world takes note. When you look like you make little people, the world shrugs. Diary of a Previously Mad Housewife. You can read that at PRI.org. Marco Werman with the Across Women's Lives team here in Nairobi, signing off for now.
Carol Hill's back in Boston now. We have just enough time before our next break for a quick holiday gift idea. We asked some of our correspondents to name the best book they've read all year, and here's our favorite of the bunch.
Merhaba, my name is Dalia Mortara, and I'm a reporter based in Istanbul, Turkey. One of my favorite books that I've read this year is Without You, There Is No Us by author Suki Kim. The book tells the story of Suki Kim's experience in North Korea. She went there undercover as a missionary, undercover as a teacher in a technical university, and basically got to interact with this elite group of boys and people that usually we wouldn't get to interact with. North Korea is a place that I personally know very little about, and I think most people don't know very much about because there is so little information out there. And that's why I couldn't put it down. It was a very personal, moving, first-person experience that really humanized North Korea in a way that I have never seen before. And I think it's perfect for anyone who wants to learn something new. So go ahead and read Without You, There Is No Us by Suki Kim. I think you'll love it. Good shoes.
Reporter Dalia Mortada's book pick for the holidays. But we've got more. To check out the full list, just head to facebook.com/PRI the world. I'm Carol Hills with The World. You might have noticed this recently. Canada's new defense minister wears a turban. That's because of his faith, Sikhism, or Sikhism, as it's often pronounced. Observant Sikh men wear a turban, and they wear their hair and beard uncut. Canada's military doesn't mind, but not okay here, according to the Pentagon's dress code. That hasn't stopped Army Major Kamal Singh Khalsi from serving, though. He's an observant Sikh who was born in India and is an ER doctor in New Jersey. Khalsi says it was a long and arduous process for him to join the U.S. military.
I got in when I was in my first year of medical school, 7 or 8 months before 9/11, and when a recruiter came and said, "Hey, would you like to join?" So I said yes, and wore my uniform, kept my turban and beard, and never had any problems. It wasn't until I went on full-time active duty that my commanding officers said that this would be an issue. They said, "Look, we support you staying in. We'll just go up the chain of command." And therein started a process that took me better part of a year and a half. 15,000 petitioners wrote in on my behalf to then Secretary of Defense Gates, 50 congressional signatures, and then pressure from the White House also.
We should remind our listeners that until 1981, Sikh Americans were able to serve in the military. It was under Ronald Reagan and Caspar Weinberger that the rule went in to not allow Sikhs because of the beard and turban. One of the reasons given was around the inability to wear a helmet with the turban on and that the beard would interfere with the gas mask. Remind us why Sikhs wear the beard and turban.
You know, the turban and the beard are part of our religious uniform. Sikhs have always been taught to stand up for the defenseless and to stand up against oppression. Our 10th guru, Guru Gobind Singh Ji, established the turban and beard as an identity for us so that anybody seeking a Sikh's help could look out and find us.
So the beard and the turban are signifiers. I want to bring us back to today. You're serving in the military. You have a long beard, which you've never cut, yet it looks trimmed. How do you get it to look like that?
I keep it very neat. You know, I tie it up at the bottom of my chin and I use a little bit of hair product and it conforms to my face very nicely. It may look like it's trimmed, but it's actually not. And that's part of the reason why I've had no issues in getting my gas mask to seal on my face.
Have you served in combat?
Yes, ma'am. I was in Afghanistan in Helmand Province in 2011. You know, Sikhs serve openly and freely in Canada, in Britain, in India, and other modern militaries throughout the world. We've known for quite some time that the helmet and the gas mask issue is, in fact, not really an issue. If you note, Special Forces and Navy SEALs routinely have relaxed grooming standards with facial hair, beards, long hair. And so we're left asking ourselves, what's the problem? If Jews can wear the yarmulke or the skull cap and they can accommodate that, why not the turban?
With the current climate as it is, a lot of Americans concerned about terrorist attacks and a lot of kind of unfortunate expressions of Islamophobia. I know Sikhs are not Muslim, but are you ever mistaken for one?
Yes, I am. You know, it would be very easy for me to say, hey, look, I'm not Muslim, but I tend not to say that because then in essence, I'm saying, well, it would be okay to discriminate against Muslims. The current atmosphere of Islamophobia in the United States needs to change because that's not the type of country we are. It's historically not who we've been.
I think part of it is there's sort of an other phobia going on. And so it, basically the having a turban and a long beard, do you ever sort of get those questions from Americans about, well, who are you and are you from here, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah, all the time. In fact, there was a period after 9/11 happened when people were really on edge. So they would stare at me. In fact, when I went to the airport, I was randomly screened 100% of the time. These things over time, you know, got better. But in recent months, perhaps as a result of this crazy political rhetoric that we're seeing around the elections, things have gotten bad again. We're seeing an increase in Sikhs being targeted for hate crimes, for bullying, for job discrimination. Just in the past month, there have been several incidents of Sikhs being called, some derogatory racial remarks being thrown at them and then being assaulted.
What do you think the impact has been on Sikhs from having you and others serve in the military?
It's a positive and uplifting thing to have a member of your own community serving in the military. Now, the military is the largest employer in the United States, and it sets the tone for the rest of the country.
Major Kelsey, is there any vote expected or any change in this policy? Or for the time being, is it going to be a case-by-case basis in terms of Sikh men serving in the military?
Well, as far as we know, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. We had a letter submitted just last month of 27 retired generals that have asked Secretary of Defense Ash Carter to change the policy for patriotic Sikh Americans that are looking to serve so that my little brother or my son or my daughter can just walk into a recruiter's office just like any other American and serve their country. You know, the process that took me a year and a half takes regular Americans just minutes.
Major Kamal Kelsey is an ER doctor in the U.S. Army Reserves. Thank you, Major Kelsey.
Thank you, ma'am.
As we heard a moment ago, it's uplifting to see your own community reflected in a respected institution like the military. Same goes for entertainment. And with all the talk recently about Donald Trump's proposed ban on Muslims entering the U.S., it got us thinking, what would our music sound like without Muslim artists in America? The World's Kieran Peterson decided to find out. And Kieran, you created a list of 10 Muslim musicians you need to know. But why focus on Muslims in pop culture?
I'm one of those people that pretty much understands the world completely through pop culture. And so the first thing that I thought after hearing Donald Trump's proposal was pop culture, famous faces, and a bunch of them came to mind, so I decided to write them all down.
Okay, so tell me some of the acts on the list. I'm guessing it's a lot more than just Cat Stevens, now known as Yusuf Islam.
I mean, there's a lot of mainstream ones. You think of Brother Ali, who's a pretty famous rapper who's been around for a while. A Tribe Called Quest, two of the members of that group are Muslims. You have Mos Def, who now goes by Yasin Bey. But there's also a couple of lesser-known acts that I kind of wanted to highlight among the greats.
Do any of the artists tackle Islamophobia directly in their work?
Yeah, it's actually a really common theme, and most of them actually take it on with humor, which is a really great way, I think, to kind of express themselves. There's actually this one artist that I really liked that I put on the list called Narcissist, and he has a song called Fatwa, spelled P-H-A-T-W-A. And it's a really eye-opening and pretty hilarious take on Islamophobia in the U.S.
The World's Kieran Peterson. Thanks so much. And do check out Kieran's full list at PRI.org. And we're going to go out today on that song. It's Fatwa by The Narcissist. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back again tomorrow.
Yeah, what kind of life is this? Out of sight, out of mind, with divisiveness. Get your head right. Betrayed and gone wrong, hold on. Adams get they roll on like backgammon, souls lost. Raps Khalil Gibran, puffin' cedar trees, cuffed on the lawn of the White House, and right now.
PRI, Public Radio International.